You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey folks, welcome to another episode of From the Backburner podcast. My name is Jonathan O'Dell, your host. And tonight is a happy hour night of sorts. I am here in Douglas, Arizona, with a good friend of mine, Tyler Webster from the Birds, Booze, and Buds podcast. Welcome, Tyler.
Thanks, John.
And so the reason why we're here, hopefully if you guys saw the lovely post I'm going to get up on Instagram here with that wonderful bar in the background. We are actually in, it was the Avenue, right?
Correct.
The Avenue. This is a bed and breakfast sort of a place hotel.
It is.
Here in Douglas, owned by Tyler's aunt.
Correct.
Robin.
We've kind of turned it into a de facto quail camp in the last several years.
It has been. This is a really cool thing. So Tyler and I are down here in Douglas because Hunt to Eat hosted a Learn to Hunt quail camp this weekend down here. And so that's why I said this was kind of our happy hour. The event's over. we have a couple libations in.
We survived
and all that. But and if you're interested, you can actually listen to the podcast we did earlier with Matting Putellas on Tyler's podcast. Again, the Birds, Booze, and Buds podcast. We got a kind of chance to wrap up with him there, and Matting had to get on the road. So
yeah, he has a long drive home.
Yeah, he had to get back up to Colorado. But really kind of a cool event that you wanted to host this year.
Yeah. You know, the older I get and the more that I've gotten into this whole thing and conservation and teaching and all that kind of stuff, the more that I really kind of try to figure out ways to give back.
Wow.
And so I talked to Matting back in, I think, in April. And I told him, because he was talking about all these camps that they're doing, these how to learn how to deer hunt or duck hunt or snow goose hunt or whatever. And I pitched a couple of ideas. I said, if you guys are interested, I would host one of my place in North Dakota in September for Sharp Tails. And I said, I'll talk to my aunt. I said, but I'm sure that she'd be interested in hosting one down at her place in Arizona in December or January. And North Dakota Game and Fish shut it down for the North Dakota one. They said that wasn't gonna fly up there. And it really is kind of sad, because it's a really good, you know, the last couple of days we really kind of got to see literally a young 17-year-old who had never held a gun before, taking him through the ethics of hunting, through you know, conservation, through all the different principles, through firearm safety in the field, hunting over dogs, all this kind of stuff. Hunting's a very small part of these camps that they're putting on.
Yeah.
It really is all about teaching people how to do things and kind of broadening their horizons. And I think that the North Dakota Game and Fish Department really kind of messed up by not allowing it. Yeah. But you guys with Arizona Game and Fish Department, you know, we ran it through you guys, made sure that, you know, like the parameters were set.
Yeah.
And you know, by following that, I think that it was a really good opportunity.
Yeah, and what's funny is I think Tyler kind of softens the blow in that, where he's like, you know, it's kind of a crash course for this. Of course, it was a young kid and his father mm-hmm. who he was really the youngest of all the ones we had. Most everyone else was a little bit older and
sure.
Folks from all over the place, but. You know, from a participant standpoint, I mean, we were pretty much, it was with a fire hose, like, you know, just this kind of introduction to, like, you know, it goes beyond the crash course. Like, there was so much information
yeah.
that they got in such a small window of time.
Information overload almost. It
really was. Yeah. And then really just being thrust into the fire of the crucible of hunting.
Well, and you know, we didn't take it easy on them either, because, the country down here really does present its own challenges.
Right.
For people who aren't used to walking and hiking, in terrain that's every step is
treacherous.
To say unlevel would be a generous statement. I mean, we're literally tripping over softball-sized pieces of lava rock down in the desert where everything pokes you. I mean, there's cat claw, there's prickly pears, there's mesquite, there's everything. And then for the afternoon hunt, well, let's throw elevation into the mix as well, and let's go up into the canyons and chase burns up and down.
Let's go march up and down hills and stuff. Yeah, that's a. It's pretty. It was a lot for those folks, but I'm.
Everybody loved it though.
They did. Yeah, I
mean, really did.
At the end of it, it's they got a very well-rounded experience for. Maybe a first time learning how to quail hunt and seeing what it's all about. And also cool, a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm.
Cause there were, doves and ducks and a jackrabbit. And I mean, just about everything. A
couple
taken.
Types of quail. Yeah.
Yeah. They got to experience it all. Actually all three quail kind of got harvested through this camp, or did we not get a Mearns?
We did not get a Mearns.
That's right.
Nick, one of the participants did not let me live it down, because I kind of made a little bit of a deal about, the spot that I took him is one of the spots that it's kind of a special spot for me. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to make you guys pledge secrecy that you're never going to go back in there, kind of a deal, because I like to go in there myself. And when we got back to the trucks yesterday evening, Nick was like, yeah, I don't think you're going to have to worry about us coming back into your secret spot. But I mean, so Mearns quail, especially this year, really does present a whole host of challenges. First of all, it's very dry.
Yeah.
We did get some rain on Friday, which was it helped a lot. It's very calm. There's not very much wind down here. No. And the grass in the Mearns Quail Canyons this year, because of all the monsoon rains, are preposterous.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's waist deep and thick. And if the dogs aren't basically right on top of them birds, you ain't going to find them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I mean, like, they're there. Me and Wade have been talking about it for the last couple of days because it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
We've just come to the conclusion that there's sign there. We know there's birds there. We just haven't found them yet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that, thankfully that is part of, we call it hunting for a reason.
That's
right.
The birds got to win sometimes.
Yeah.
It's never fun when they do, but they need to win every once in a while.
Yeah. It can be challenging. I mean, obviously today we run through some thick country, and I got a chance to go out with the folks today.
Thick country, yeah.
And
understatement of the decade. It was like trying to walk through a jungle with thorns. It was awful.
Well, while they were doing that, as we were walking around, I saw some choya fruit, and I was like, this looks like a much better hunt for me. I'm just gonna pick up fruit instead of trying to shoot birds and stuff, and give everyone else a shot at it. But yeah, it was a good time, but yeah, kind of worry out. I mean, thankfully,
oh man,
thankfully, I mean, we've had just a tremendous amount of food available to keep everybody going and well, full and all that stuff.
I'm not sure how I can walk 20,000 steps a day and still gain weight, but I think I've accomplished it this week.
Well, Hank talked about. I mean, quail is really the only calorie negative sport at the end of the day, from what you get out of it in birds to what you're expending to get
on
them,
on a good quail hunt, you can maybe get a pound or two of meat. Maybe. Meanwhile, you're burning 4,000 calories.
But on top of that, the fact that we have eaten plenty and plenty good this whole time. Thankfully for new participants, I think, we there were participants from coast to coast. I mean, we had LA, we had Virginia, mm-hmm. Alabama,
yep.
Just
Indiana.
Texas,
yep. New Mexico.
It was quite the assemblage of folks and all that, kind of got to experience this. And to me, I really like this, because when you look at kind of that hunter recruitment that's kind of been going on all across the country, mm-hmm. the large focus has been on kids, and the fact that Hunty kind of came up with a different model. Most of the camps that you end up seeing out there are usually given for free.
Sure.
Take people out, all this other stuff, but there really is a niche out there that wasn't being filled that Hunty really kind of glommed onto and said, you know, there's a lot of adults who would like to learn how to hunt.
Yeah.
And of course they're willing to invest in that experience.
Right.
And kind of where this camp idea for them, you know, came up from. And so, really serving, I think, an underserved demographic in this country,
Oh, I would agree with that. I mean, you know, the whole phenomena of adult onset hunting is fascinating to me.
Sure.
I have a couple friends, one of my best friends, Nate, he didn't start hunting until he was 30. And now he's got three bird dogs, hunts harder than I do. I mean, like it's almost like he hunts like he's making up for lost time. I mean, and these are people that are coming into it at a point in their life where they can actually afford to do these things, where, you know, he can afford to buy dogs and he can go on these trips and he can get these experiences that he's kind of been wanting to do in a way for his whole life.
Right.
And, it's the people that are coming into it now at this late stage in life, I think that they're actually almost, and I don't want to pit old hunters against new hunters, but I think that they have a better mindset even than some of the traditional hunters that have been out there for a long time, that it kind of started taking it for granted a little bit. Like, these people that are coming into it, they're extremely excited to learn. They're not, like, they have no idea what they're doing and they're very willing to admit it. Whereas a lot of the old guard that's been there for a long time, you know, they may have their, like we were talking about in my podcast earlier, they have their lane that they're really good at, but they're not very comfortable with getting outside that lane.
Yeah.
And these new people that are coming in their 20s, 30s, and even 40s, and later, like Wolf, one of the mentors who was here, he didn't start hunting until he was like 50 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Very late in life. And, you know, now he's really kind of jumped in head first. And it's really kind of a cool thing to see. And I hope it continues.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's, I think when you look at the overall, that was really the message was, you know, they talk about the demographic of hunters and for vast majority of the country, that means, you know, there's a boomer population.
Mm-hmm.
That is very high. It kind of skews it tilts the scale,
mm-hmm.
but they're the ones who are aging out.
Right.
And when you looked backwards, across the generations, you know, after that, like there wasn't the backfill of the same level,
sure.
you know, to kind of go in. And so obviously, you know, by sheer numbers, boomers, you know, should have maybe kind of a higher thing, but,
sure.
you know, X had kind of tapered off and then millennials and it just has continually gone down. And so that's really where the recruitment has tried to dig into, you know, it seems like with the focus on everyone else, it was really on Gen Z,
mm-hmm.
you know, to try and create a bump
right.
After there, but it misses
and,
millennials, and it misses, you know, some of
sure.
the Xers who may be
and
interested.
They're trying to find a bump in a demographic where there are so many distractions in today's life, whether it would be, you know, cell phones or like people are busy and mm-hmm. they're stressed and they got a lot of stuff going on. And so it's really kind of hard to try to compete for that time window. But yeah. when you get to see the people that actually do come out and see it and kind of unplug a little bit and really kind of take that breath,
right.
it's something that I think that it's, first of all, it's needed. It's necessary for all of us to kind of try to take some time and get outside and just do some of these things that it's just like soul restoring. But it's hard. They're trying to compete in a marketplace that's pretty over. It's a busy marketplace.
Well, I hear what you're saying on the distractions. It seems like to me that when this becomes the distractions,
right?
You know, when hunting becomes the distraction, a lot of the other ones go away.
Oh, it's my distraction.
And and well, yeah. And so, you know, I complain about myself sometimes, you know, or you talk to most anyone. It's like there are things that get in the way, like preventing you from getting out and doing this. I mean,
nothing prevents me from getting out and doing this.
Well, it's like, man, I wanted to go hunt this weekend, but this thing came up or whatnot.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because hunting in the past was always called like an avocation. You know, it wasn't your primary, your vocation was your job and your kind of your life, but this was the escape from that, you know? And so, where it was like, you know, you didn't want to have to deal with work and those kind of things. And,
right.
And you get into, you know, just being here in the moment, right. And the, you know,
yeah.
Not having a lot of those other problems to worry about or and possibly even working through some of those issues in life, you know.
Very much so. I'll tell you, I learned a secret. Just say no to everything during hunting season. And after a few years of doing that, people just stop asking you to do anything, and then you're just your calendar opens up.
They're like, "Oh, it's his hunting season. He's not going to want to do any of that stuff."
One of my best friends, he was he pitched the idea that his wife really wanted to get married in October, and I was like, "Man, I'll send you a nice gift." And he's like, "No, you're my best man." I was like, yeah, not going to be there.
Yeah. Well, I tell my friends, I mean, a lot of, you know, guys who I started bringing into hunting and all that other stuff, right. You know, I told them, I said, look, you need to plan your life out properly. Okay. Right. There are some life choices you need to make. Right. One of them is you don't get married during the season.
Right.
Right. You make sure to plan when that kid's going to be born.
Yeah. Valentine's Day, very dangerous day.
Very, very bad stuff. Dangerous day. You know? And it's like, you know, make sure your life, like don't have birthdays, don't anniversaries. None of that stuff should happen during the prime time. And, cause it can be complicated.
Well, it's just, you're just setting yourself up for a lifetime worth of fights is what you're doing.
One of the things, it's funny. One of my friends is his wife's birthday is September 1st. I mean, and how in the world in Arizona, you know, like your wife's birthday is September 1st. From the beginning, he set the precedent.
Yeah.
He goes dove hunting on September 1st.
Sure.
In the morning and stuff. Now he has to make up for it.
Well, yeah. You don't have to hunt all day on September 1st. It's day one of the season. I mean, and a lot of times, maybe you're living it out by like 10. Sure.
But yeah, those are kind of the life lessons of.
Well, and I mean, to be fair, there's about 5% of us that go this completely insane. Sure. I mean, like there are a lot of people. I have a lot of friends that are very good hunters and outdoorsmen and fishermen and the hikers and everything else that are very happy doing it 15 days a year and on the weekends. I can't do that. That is not, I don't live there.
Sure. Well, you know, and we do know that, I mean, Randy Newberg has like, he gives like the best marriage advice.
Oh, I listen to it, even though I'm not married.
Right. He gives the best marriage advice. Like I have worked long and hard with my, I give terrible marriage advice, first of all, but the few things I will say that somehow I lucked out in, I was telling Motting this and he's like, man, that's like Newberg level. He's like, you gotta give me that secret. Cause my wife now has figured out that when we want to go on vacation, or when she wants to go on vacation, sometimes she tries to sell me on the vacation on what I can do hunting or fishing wise while we're there.
That's good. And, that's good marketing on her part.
Oh yeah. Yeah. She can sell me on that stuff and, you know, lines up so that I can sneak away for like maybe a day or two and go, you know, experience that and stuff. So it's been hugely beneficial. I mean, like I think I started working on her pretty early to say, you know, we should do that. Oh, guess what we could do while I'm there. Yeah. Yeah. This hunt going right. on or something, you know, well, we could try fishing or something. So, you know, and it's not like one of those obvious ones where it's like, you know, hey, we're going to go to Alaska. Well, I think if you're going to go to Alaska, it's like, yeah, we're probably going to get on a fishing right. boat and try and do some fishing.
Hey, honey, do you want to go to North Dakota the second week of October and go up there and just hang out for a few? No, nobody's going to buy that, John.
Right, for sure. Well, and once I had discovered Hawaii, honestly, hands down, I love bird hunting in a lot of other states. Hawaii was probably the most insane bird hunting
I've heard.
I've ever experienced on the Big Island. Mm-hmm. Part of it was because it isn't like, you know, like we're down here and okay, you know, there's quail. And so we might be in an area where it could be a gambles or it could be a scale quail. Mm-hmm. And we might see a dove, you know, flush out of the grass when we're doing all that stuff. When you're in Hawaii and they threw the dogs out, they were birdied the moment they hit the ground out of the truck. Mm-hmm. It was the craziest thing to see. But, and then all of a sudden they're going on point. What the real big question was, is what bird is coming out of the grass? Mm-hmm. Cause you don't know, right. You know, they have four different pheasants, three different Franklins, sand grouse. We flushed turkeys out of this fireweed grass they had out there. Yeah. a full, like, you know, Rio Grande turkey is hiding in this grass. The same with all these pheasants and stuff. So it was like, okay, dog's on point. Let's, you know, see what we can do.
And as somebody,
you gotta watch your limits on stuff.
As somebody who has had a turkey flush off of a point, clean underwear may be needed. I mean, we're talking about earth-shattering flush. Like, it is a startling thing.
No, it was crazy and stuff. But then when you think about that, you have to really watch your limits,
right?
On stuff, because it was like, okay, well, the limit for pheasants is this, and the limit for Franklins is this, and right. And so it was, really watch and pay attention and stuff.
I can't do it though, because I can't take my own dogs there. Like the loophole or the hoops you have to jump through to try to get your dogs to go to Hawaii is nuts.
Yeah,
and I, as much as I love hunting, I love hunting over my dogs more.
Well, your dogs would have an interesting time in Hawaii if they were there.
Yeah.
Based on how many feral cats.
My dogs have no problem with cats.
Really? They don't want to try and chase and eat them?
Nope.
Oh, well, zero. They could have fun doing it.
Zero desire. In fact, funny story. Some people who like cats, if you have a huge cat contingency to listen to your podcast, sure. I don't know that they would like the story, but... I had for a whole year, I had this big black tomcat in my yard out on my farm in North Dakota that I would occasionally see. I could never get it. Like, and I mean, when I mean get it, I mean get it. Capital G-E-T-I-T. One night, I'm sitting on my couch, literally watching That 70s Show in November, and it's pretty cold, and out on my deck, I can hear, meow. I was like, oh, I got you now. And so I go outside and I bring all three dogs out. I was like, I just got this German short hair. Those things will kill a cat. I open up the door. It's not that cat. It's a little year old kitten or something that somebody dropped off in the country because people are dicks. And all three of my dogs like ran up to it and sniffed it. The cat ran in the house and all three dogs went and laid down by it. I was like, oh, come on. Like, you talk about the biggest backfire of all time. I mean, and so it ends up costing me money to get the cat fixed. And then I end up having to home it for a while until I can find somebody to take the dang thing. And all because I thought that I had this badass dog that would go out there and potentially kill this cat.
And eat cats.
Negative. Did not happen that way at all. My dogs do not have a problem with cats.
Yeah. I was really blown away by the number of cats when I was in Hawaii. Mm. At the resort, everything else.
Well, you would think that if there's that many cats, there would not be that many birds.
Well, and so I ended up staying at like the Waikoloa Resort. It's a Hilton resort there. And I was there for a meeting. And what's interesting about this
resort. You get to go to the coolest meetings.
I know. Well, so I'm at this place. Well, they have an endangered goose species in Hawaii called the Nene.
Okay.
Okay.
Isn't that a dance?
It is now. Yeah.
Interesting.
But
it's based on the goose, I wonder.
Who knows? Could be. But so they have this goose here, and at the Hilton there, they actually have a pen, like a little zoo pen with plexiglass windows and stuff. It's open air on top. But here's all these geese in this pen, and I think it's all part of like either educating folks, but also like a holding place for birds that like can't be released into the wild. Sure. They could have been injured and not be able to fly anymore.
Mini rehab kind of a deal.
Yeah, but it was cool for me to go see them. I was like, I'd walk by them every day and check them out. They're a cool looking goose. And but I was like, man, I'm like, cats most other places, like they would be like trying to figure out a way in there as they kill that thing and eat it. Or maybe the goose is just too big. It's not like a large goose or anything. I think probably a regular tomcat could take it out. That it was always the odd part to me. And then I would sit in my hotel room early in the mornings. I'd go out on the balcony, mm-hmm. and watch. They had these golf course. You could see this golf course from up there. And I'd watch the mongoose run around the golf courses that they had brought out there. Yeah, it was very, very strange. Kind of a surreal experience. I'm like, because at first I was like, what is that running around on the golf course? Because they almost look like ferrets,
Right, right.
I'm like, what
that's a weird looking mink.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, wait, that's a mongoose and stuff. Right. So and turkeys are nuisances there.
Right.
That's the other weird. I drove through a neighborhood and there were literally turkeys sitting on the trunks of cars.
Mm.
In a neighborhood, roosting at night, and I was like, "What? How? No wonder why they're like, yeah, go, you know,
lack
go
shoot of a bunch hunt, of lack of a hunting culture.
Go
is a problem.
Go shoot a bunch of turkeys. You know, their limits are pretty generous in the fall.
I bet
for fall turkeys, but yeah, really kind of wild. You've been bird hunting. I mean, obviously, you spend a lot of your year traveling and bird hunting and all that other
136 stuff. 136 days a year.
And I know you like Arizona, but do you have, like, any other favorites, like, throughout your year that you're kind of like?
Well, I can give you a couple. Yeah. I can't, like, North Dakota is always going to be number one for me. It's home, for starters. And this is the first year in a long time that I really didn't I didn't really adventure out too terribly much this year. So I started my season this year with a pretty epic Montana trip that I've been doing now for a couple years. And when I got home from that, I was like, okay, North Dakota is where I'm going to be for this year because our bird numbers were bonkers for starters. And it was the first time in I think 5 years where I didn't take any other trips out of state from like say September 10th until now. And I kind of like, it was kind of almost like a coming home season for me where it's like, okay, this is actually, it's still pretty dang cool. You know, I mean, I can go out and I can walk out of my house and go and shoot three different species of birds from my yard. I can go out and shoot sharp-tailed grouse and Hungarian partridge and pheasants. And I've shot snow geese off of my porch. I shot a swan off my deck one day that I was very concerned was going to land on my roof and cause structural damage. But so North Dakota is always going to be number one for me. I mean, it's a very special place. It's been a destination for wing shooters for a very long time and with very well deserved. And I know you can attest to that because I took you hunting up there. Mm-hmm. I have Montana is fantastic. I really do like hunting over there. South Dakota, like I get pheasants at home. I can do without that. But the Fort Pierre National Grassland for prairie chickens is a pretty special place as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, it's really hard to pick. You know, Kansas bobwhites, rough grouse in Michigan. 3 days tops for the rough grouse in Michigan. Yeah. After that, it gets to be a little redundant. You can only get whacked in the face with branches so many times before it stops being fun. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, North Dakota, Arizona, and probably Montana have to be my top three.
Yeah. Yep. Any bucket lists, hunts, or places like you have?
Well, next year is going to be some – there's going to be some things happening. I'm taking a little bit of a risk a little bit. I'm hiring a camera guy to follow me around for a season because, you know, why not, for starters. But part of the reason is because I've finally decided that I'm going to go ahead and do one of my bucket list hunts. It's Alaska for ptarmigan, and I'm driving all the way there, road tripping up, going to be their opening day in August. Going to try to hunt all three species of ptarmigan, going to try to do sharp tails over by Fairbanks, going to try to do spruce grouse, rough grouse, and just lay it all out. I'm going to be up in Alaska for probably 2 weeks. And then, of course, do some halibut fishing and salmon fishing and everything else.
You try and do, like, the whole Alaskan upland slam?
Going to try. I mean, yeah. I have no idea if it's doable or not. I mean, I know, thankfully, having done my podcast now for 4 years, I've got some dudes that that I know and that they don't owe me any favors, but they will do me a favor. Sure. So, you know, and they know that I will return the favor if they ever come down this way. Meaning the states at all. And so I'm going to have some local help. And that's one of the coolest things about social media and podcasting world and all that kind of stuff is that, you know, it kind of makes things like that possible. Because if I get up to Alaska, I can look at the country and be like, what now? Like, I'm here, but where do I go? You know, and I mean, I can do some research. I can talk to biologists such as yourself. I can talk to Game and Fish. I can talk to whatever.
Yeah.
But without that local knowledge, the learning curve is pretty freaking long.
Sure.
I'm going to try to do the three species of ptarmigan are really kind of my goal.
Sure.
Because I've done spruce grouse and rough grouse and sharptails. I haven't done the sharptails in Alaska, but I've shot plenty of sharptails and they're similar, right? So that is definitely one of them. The other one I don't know if I'm going to do it yet this year. I'm away back home from down here, but Chucker.
Yeah.
Haven't done it yet. And in all honesty, I'm a little bit nervous that I just don't have quite what it takes physically to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, I'm not getting any younger, and I know that I can go up and down Merns Quail Canyons. I mean, like, it can be steeper, but, you know, I'll just do what I can and see if I can get one or not.
Nice.
Yeah, I don't have that many species left to knock off the bucket list.
Yeah.
I got mountain quail and valley quail, which I hope to check off next year as well. Chucker, and then the three ptarmigans, and that's it. I've done all the rest of them.
I want to give you a super pro tip from personal experience on mountain quail. Shoot them uphill only from you. I have been in the coastal range.
Yes.
And in a very, very steep segment and shot one below me.
Yes.
That rolled all the way to the bottom, mm-hmm. and I had to go all the way down to retrieve it and come up. Of course, you have dogs, but and then had to come all the way back up to where I was because we were working our way uphill. So it was a little frustrating to say the least.
I have made a career out of being the downhill guy. So anything that I can do to make it easier for me, I'll take any advice I can get.
Yeah, shoot them uphill so they roll down to you instead of all the way to the bottom. So I want to pivot just a little bit because I think you made a really kind of a great segue for that. Recently, Matt Ranella posted about how, you know, how the social media goings on in hunting have kind of ruined the sport and are ruining that aspect of it. But one of the things, you know, you just touched on it here. It's something similar to me where there are some great, whether you agree with or disagree with his statement, there are some definite positive things that social media has done for hunting in terms of exposure and all that. When I came up to visit you all those years ago, you had to do some work for a couple of days, and I wanted to go chase sandhill cranes in the middle of the state.
Right.
A guy reached. I posted, "Hey, I'm up in North Dakota. You know, great hanging out with Tyler and stuff." And a guy reached out to me because mm-hmm. you know, said, "Hey, I'm heading over here to hopefully go chase sandhill cranes." He's like, "Hey, man, I live over here," and da 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 da. And he had been like scouting out the cranes. And so he sends me a message through Instagram. We chat. I head over. I meet him at a bar the night I get over there.
As one does in North Dakota.
Yeah. Met him there. Never met this guy before in my life. You know, he'd followed my page or followed my account, and I had followed him. And we talked about it. And he set me up basically on the fields for the next morning because I was going to get there too late to be able to scout it myself.
Right.
And, a huge win on my behalf, you know, and a really nice guy to boot. And, you know, obviously, you know, you get to know a lot of folks through social media who've never either met in person or any of that stuff. Sure. And, but those connections aren't ones that you would kind of normally or readily make otherwise by any other means.
Right. For me, it's all about I'm all about helping folks, trying to make their experience the best that it can be. For any of the states that I hunt in, I will readily give information. I'm not going to give spots. And I do definitely think that there is an ethical area there that needs to be talked about a little bit. I mean, everybody knows that people have been screaming about hot spotting for years.
Right.
Let's define hot spotting just for a second, because I got a couple really funny stories about this.
Right.
Hot spotting to me would be like, go to this spot and then walk that direction and shoot said birds or animal or whatever.
Right.
Not a broad geographic area. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I had people, I had a guy this year. I can't remember his name. If I could, I would actually say it because, I called him. He sent me a message, and it was kind of so funny that I felt inclined. I was like, here's my phone number. Please call me because I'd really like to talk to you a little bit more about this. So I was hunting spruce grouse this year in Northwest Montana. And I said on Instagram, I'm hunting spruce grouse in Northwest Montana. And I get this long Instagram message about how It's a finite resource and a finite amount of land for people who don't own their own and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, Montana's the third biggest state in the country, behind Texas and Alaska. Northwest Montana is the size of freaking Iowa. I'm not hotspotting by saying Northwest Montana. That is not even close to the definition of hotspotting. So, and I've had it, like, when I started, I did a couple TV shows with The Flush and stuff like that, and they identified the town that I live in. They asked me, they're like, would you mind if we said Stanley, North Dakota? I said, no. I said, first of all, I've been talking about it for years on my podcast already. I mean, if people don't already know where basically exactly where my house is at, they can probably figure it out. It doesn't bother me. Right. Like, by saying a town, people still have to do their own work to go out and figure it out. You can ask me what kind of habitat I'm finding them in, what kind of whatever. And then you can go out and you can kind of find your own spots all on your own. And it really does come down to how somebody asks me for information. If somebody sends me a message, hey, I need a spot, I'm looking for pheasants, where do I go? Well, I'm probably not going to answer that question. If you say, hey, I'm up here, I'm looking for pheasants, I'm over by this town, what are you finding them in? What should I be focusing on? What shouldn't I be focusing on? I will answer that question. And so the whole conversation and the article the article that Matt Ranella wrote, I think it's a little bit misguided. I think that social media has a lot of net positives for hunters. Mm-hmm. Especially for people who have a little bit of an adventurous spirit that want to go and try something new that they haven't done before.
Sure.
Say somebody from the East Coast, they're like, man, what I'd really like to do is go down to Arizona and go hunt Mearns quail.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, good luck. I mean, without asking for help and like even asking you or the Game and Fish or hiring a guide or something like that, you're kind of like it's a long shot that you're actually going to have a trip that's successful enough to make you want to return.
Sure.
So by making a post in something like the Project Upland community page or, reaching out to a podcast or putting a post up on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, maybe there's somebody out here in Arizona that wants to go to where you're at and do what your state is really good at. Mm. There's nothing wrong at all in my mind with sharing information. I think that it's a really good thing and it makes our community tighter as a group.
Yeah.
That's my thoughts on the whole thing. Oh. I have shared a lot of information. I've taken a lot of information. And I will continue to do so both ways.
Yeah. And there are some things so as an example, waterfowl hunting here in Arizona.
Sure.
Okay. I think a lot of people, because we have so few waterfowl hunters, they like to think that sometimes they found a secret spot.
There are no secret spots anymore.
That's what I keep trying to point out. It's like, as limited as water is here,
right,
and as dedicated as the duck hunters are here, mm-hmm, it might be secret for a week.
Maybe.
Okay. But if birds are piling into it, mm-hmm, and you're getting them, even if you don't share pictures or any other stuff with no identifying characteristics or whatnot, guys will be out scouting. They'll be like, man, I see a bunch of ducks diving in over there. I need to go check it out. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they're there. The guy who's been there for a week already comes in. Oh, my God, it's ruined. Somebody must have, told him where it was or, stuff. But I'm like,
yeah,
there really are no secrets
no.
to the folks who are really – dedicated into finding stuff.
Right.
You know, it's especially with public lands.
Right.
I mean, how big of a secret is public lands?
Right. Oh, that was the other example that I had. I had somebody from down here yelled at me for saying that I was hunting Mern's quail in the Chiricahuas. Or no, not in the Chiricahuas, in the Coronado.
Yeah, Coronado Safari.
It's 175,000 acres.
Yeah.
That's not hotspot. I'm sure. Sorry. I mean, like, it's a big place, yeah. Right? I mean, like, it's...
Over several mountain ranges.
Yes, yes. It's like, come on, guys. I mean, like, let's use a... It's not a secret that there are Mern's quail in the Coronado.
Pretty much that's where most of them exist.
That is their range, yes. Right? So, I mean, like, it's... It can be a positive and it could be a negative, but... You know, and I understand that I'm definitely biased because I come from a state where, I mean, ducks definitely outnumber people like multiple times to one, right?
Right.
I live in a state of 700,000 people or whatever, where most states have, Phoenix is bigger than my state by a lot. So I understand that my perspective is going to be a little bit different, but, you know, just... Get out there and go and find new spots. Like, I don't like hunting the same damn spots anyways. I want to go out there and find new spots.
Sure.
And when you're hunting on public land, it's just that. It's public. So if somebody else finds that spot, you tip your hat to them. You say, good luck, man. I know there's some birds in there. Go have some fun. And you go and find something else.
Yeah.
There's endless amounts of opportunity in spots.
Well, I think one of the things that a lot of people don't talk about or don't consider is... the perception that all of us hunters have about hunting and about hunter crowding,
mm-hmm.
and what works and what, I mean, Wade is like my primary example. Wade's our lingo, good friend of ours. He's my prime example. He's the kind of guy who, when he goes out hunting, he doesn't want to see another hunter.
Right.
You know, he doesn't want to run into anyone. It's, you know, like, he wants to feel like at least his yeah. coveys and stuff are just his.
Sure.
You know, and in some ways, you know, it kind of ruins his experience a little bit when he sees someone else out there.
Sure.
But can two hunters share a landscape of, you know, however large, sure. you know, 40, 50, 100,000, yeah. 200,000 acres? I mean, like, whatever it is.
Right.
You know, because... that public ground or whatever, I mean, it isn't just his.
Right.
It's also whoever he runs into. And like we said, there are no kind of secret spots, or at least they won't remain a secret forever.
Right.
You know, you can't seem to hold on. It's like holding on to air. I mean, right. eventually.
Like our friend Ron Baim from the Hunting Dog Podcast says, he's like, you know, when I go to one of my spots and I see a truck in one of my spots, I don't get mad. I get excited because it gives me an opportunity to have a conversation and share a beer with somebody at the end of the day.
Sure.
You know, and I really do look at it that way a lot. And once he said that, I'm like, yeah, man, like I like stopping and talking with other hunters and seeing how they're doing.
Sure.
You know, if it's, especially if I see, like women and or kids out there, I've seen it a lot of times where you can just tell that people are kind of struggling. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very, very willing to just stop and be like, hey, how's it going? You guys have any luck? And if they're like, man, we're getting our butts kicked. It's like, well, you know, go up here and check this spot out. I think there's a few birds in there or whatever. And the other thing about hunting down here, I could tell people exactly where to go and look for Mern's quail, and the chance of them finding them coveys is not 100%.
Right.
I mean, like, it's far less than that. We saw on Thursday, me and Motting and Wade went into a spot just to kind of go and scout a little bit. And we ended up seeing a tank with a bunch of mallards on it. And so me and Wade went sneaking up there. I whacked, I shot a double on greenheads, and Wade got one. And when we're standing there, he sends his dog Oakley down for the retrieve. And she's bringing one of the ducks back. And then he sends her down for the retrieve again. And I watch a Mern's quail get up and fly up onto the side of a hill. And I said, Wade, did you see that? I think that was a Mern's quail. And just then another one took off and went up and landed right in the same spot. He said, oh my gosh, that was Mern's quail. So we get both ducks, all three ducks. We walk back to the truck, grab our vests, and grab Shiloh, his dog, who's one of the most experienced Mern's quail dogs that there is, really. And we walk right down there to exactly where we saw those birds land. And she's tracking and birdie and pointing and tracking and tracking and tracking and birdie and pointing. Never found them.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, like, there, it's not a guaranteed thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like we were talking about earlier, the birds do win, and especially down here, and when the sending conditions are the way they are.
Yeah.
I could tell somebody, I could drop a pin and be like, go to this tree and shoot, or I could drop a pin into that wash we were in today for gambles. Mm-hmm. Go to this wash and shoot gambles. There's gambles in there.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Well, and so, like I said, I mean, there are people who are kind of at that extreme level. Well, they don't want to see anyone, you know, or you know, if they see maybe it's not the end of the world, sure. You know, but you know, maybe it's just like, you know, it's irritating, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I defy anyone, you know, some of my experiences are a little more solitary like mm-hmm. that, but come with me to Yuma, Arizona,
right.
Okay? Me and 20,000 of my closest friends, half of them from California,
right.
Go and invade Yuma.
Right.
And opening morning, we are, for the most part, I mean, you can go down to the 3 miles of shooters, right? Everyone is stacked up 15 to 20 yards apart. At least hundreds of people just on this single road.
Right.
Okay. All pointing in the same direction. And guess what? The craziest part about it all, everyone's happy.
Everybody gets along. Yeah.
Right. Everyone attempts, you know, is being safe the best that they can. I mean, sometimes there's a little bit of like, you know, oh, you're crowding me or whatever. And, you know, sure. Oh, we were here first, whatever, you know, first kind of thing in the morning. But at the end of the day, it's all smiles. Everyone gets their birds.
Right.
No issues.
Yeah.
Now, I defy anyone out there who's like, you know, oh, hunter crowding's an issue. Come with me.
Sure.
You want to see hunters?
Right.
I will show you hunters.
Yeah, hold my beer.
Do 20,000 people show up to your hometown? I mean, other than like maybe, you know, Aberdeen or something in South Dakota for pheasant season or something, do you see mobs of hunters invading a spot,
right.
You know, where it's like, okay, this is good.
Yeah, and plus, what does that do to the local economy in Yuma?
Oh, it's huge. Yeah. Opening weekend is about like $6 million.
Sure.
You know, just
when you talk about economy. You talk about like Aberdeen or Mobridge in South Dakota, they want to see hunter crowding.
Oh yeah,
because it means dollar signs coming into their community.
Mm-hmm.
And us as hunters, they're not going to take all the birds, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of money that they're going to bring in is going to have a huge positive on boat ramps and shooting ranges and
sure.
like trap teams for kids and all this kind of stuff that's going to be putting money back into conservation, plus the amount of money they're spending in bars and restaurants and hotels like this. I mean, this little hotel here that my aunt has, without quail hunters, I don't know if it would have been, if it'd still be open.
Yeah. Well, the Yuma Catholic High School,
right?
Parents come down because they do 175 gun raffle, you know, after the, it's their fundraiser. All these hunters coming down to Yuma and all that stuff, they've got it set up. You buy tickets. It's like, yeah, here's a $20, you know, a whack for this huge gun raffle. And it's just, I mean, it's a ton of
stuff.
Start
asking people to buy raffle tickets after they're about three margaritas deep and watch the 20s come out.
Oh yeah. But it's one of those things where, you know, I would defy you, you know, to say, just to even aside from the economic benefit.
Sure.
We as hunters talk about improving our image to the public and all that stuff. And when you have an entire town, okay, of people who are supportive behind you,
mm-hmm.
that a city might come up and go to bat for you.
Right.
You know, because our town relies on hunting.
Right.
You know, I mean, that says something even more than just, you know, hunters kind of go, no, we're good people and all that other stuff. I mean, like, you know, a town can literally say, no, we want hunters.
Right.
We need it. And our image in that town
goes up,
you know, well, it's just, it is important. You know, those are kind of some of those other things. The fact that we show up and support and go to local businesses. You know, when I go crane hunting, I mean, they're here in these small towns here in southeastern Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And I make sure to, man, I stop and get gas and I stop and get ice. And I go eat at the local restaurants,
yes.
You know, and I want them to see us there. Cause I want them to go, oh, you know, the crane hunters are here.
Mm-hmm.
Because they come every single year and, you know, buy some food and, you know, have a couple of dinners here, whatnot, order pizza. You know, aside from just, you know, what we're cooking in camp and doing all that stuff. I mean, I think those things are important.
Oh, for sure.
You know, where it's an even smaller town than Yuma. I mean, you know, Yuma at least is fairly sizable by comparison. I mean, you know, I go into a town of, you know, just a couple hundred, you know, 300, 400. It's like, anytime you show up in a small town like that, I mean, that's noticeable. They're like, right. Oh, the sure. guys with camo are here.
Right.
What's all that about? Right. So, you kind of get to see some of that, you know, I think, in different ways, but yeah, in terms of improving an image, you know, like there are more than one way to do it. And so heck, the fact that I can't remember where I was. I was so impressed with the fact that South Dakota had hired a marketing firm, mm-hmm. To sell the pheasant hunt.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a state
in the most famous pheasant hunting state in the country already.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, but like actually advertising it across the country in different magazines, social media, you know, however they mm-hmm. were doing it, you know, to have a state that supports hunting.
Yeah.
Like that. That's impressive.
Yeah.
You know, that it's a viable economic. I mean, the fact that the Board of Tourism sees it, you know, local governance, all that kind of comes together to say, you know, hunting's important to our state. It's an import or an yeah. export.
Yeah.
That's valuable.
Yeah. It drives the economy.
Yeah. To me, that should is what hunters should kind of take into mind and go, yeah, you know what? Opening day in South Dakota is probably pretty thick.
Well, there's a reason why there's no school in South Dakota on opening day of pheasant season, or deer season, or, you know, I mean, like it's a holiday.
Yeah.
It's a holiday at the local schools.
Yeah. So like, you know, I mean, to me sometimes, and you know, it may just be me, but sometimes, you know, it's like, man, I saw somebody out there, it just irritates me and ticks me off. Yeah. Like, I just can't even take it seriously.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm like, you know, and there's actually been scientific research done on hunter crowding issues and the fact that it actually didn't matter how many people were out there.
Well,
it was a self perception of what you think hunting should be.
Yeah.
Not the fact of like what the actual density of hunters was per square mile or any of that other stuff.
Right. You know, Wednesday's really an example. We were kind of there. Well, there was a guy on Instagram who was, we'll say he was having a little hissy about this whole hunt to eat camp. And, you know, he was talking about, oh, geez, you know, I was walking in boot prints all day and there's people out there with 30 dogs and camps of 20 people and all this kind of stuff. And me and Wade went down into the most famous area in Mearns Quail country.
Yeah.
We seen a guy with one dog driving around on the roads and that was it.
No.
We never seen any other trucks. We never seen anybody walking. Nothing. So I don't know where all these dudes were at. I don't know if they got abducted by aliens or what sure. happened. But I think a lot of it comes down to you know, some of these guys, they have a spot that they hunt every year.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time that they see somebody in that spot, they feel attacked.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, and a lot of times there's emotion to a lot of that stuff because maybe it's a spot that they went to with their dad or their grandpa or, you know, whatever. Maybe that's the first spot that their first dog pointed a bird or whatever.
Sure.
I can understand, you know, I got spots like that that are special to me. But if you really only have that one spot, maybe you're not that much of a hunter. You know, like it's really kind of hard to say, and I don't mean to sound heartless or anything else, but you know, I got so many spots in North Dakota and down here that I'm, you know, if I go to a spot and I see somebody else there, well, you found a good one, you know, I'm going to go down the road. Yeah. I got a spot, you know.
Well, at the very least, not just having one spot, but having backups.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have backups, you know, things change. I mean, obviously, you know, we've seen all kinds of stuff environmentally, you know, like think of the California fires.
Mm.
Okay. Imagine you had a great, like this was
really
your deer
good mountain
spot.
Or mountain quail,
you know,
spot.
Yeah. And now it's scorched and gone.
Right.
I see that here in Arizona. I mean, up in the White Mountains.
Yeah.
Man, I had some great bluegrass spots up there
mm-hmm.
before the last big fires went through, the Bear Wallow and all that stuff. And it's sad to me because I go back there now and part of me, like, I enjoy the memories that I have of grouse hunting there. You know, it was spectacular, but of course it doesn't look anything like it does today, you know, and it won't come back in my lifetime.
Right.
You know, the spruce fir conifer for like,
yeah, it takes too long.
It's not going to come back and to have the grouse come back. And so the one thing that I do kick myself, I think a little bit on it is that, man, why didn't you enjoy this more?
Sure.
Why you still had it?
Sure.
You know, like, oh man, it's gone. And so I'll never be able to, you know, hit that spot again. And so, just having your spot,
right?
I mean, well, things happen,
right? It's kind of like those people that all day long today. And again, I really do love all my listeners and everything else, but I get a lot of messages. They're like, "What are bird numbers like? We're thinking about coming down to Arizona." It's like, well, if you're thinking about coming down, come down. Yeah. It doesn't matter what bird numbers are like. I mean, it's better than staying at home in Minnesota when there's nothing else to do
and it's frozen.
It's nice weather. People are great. Food's fantastic. You're going to find birds if you walk. Yeah. But it's a lot like those people that, you know, if bird numbers just don't look good, you know, we'll go out next year.
Yeah. Somehow success started getting gauged in harvest.
Right.
Like in successful harvest.
Right.
And, you know, you hear a lot about it, like in hunter ethics and hunter ed classes and all that other stuff. It's like killing something isn't the measure of success of that hunt.
Right.
You know,
the memories are.
Yeah. And the experience and all those things, you know, maybe either being out there with friends and family and all that other stuff. But yeah, so many times I think people get caught up in the you know, a successful hunt means that I've harvested limits every day and all that other stuff. I mean, one of the funny things is it, 'cause part of bird hunting too is it's relative. There's all these relativity scales regionally and state to state about things. When I first got to Minnesota and my first, like I finally was in the North Woods in bird hunting season, I was like, yes, man, I'm going to go get to hunt rough grouse for the first time. Heard all about, right? I got up there, started talking to a guy. Yeah. Oh, you know, you do anything after this meeting? I'm like going, yeah, man, I'm going grouse hunting. They said, oh man, it's really bad you came this year. It's a terrible year. It's a terrible year. And I'm like, well, okay. I mean, I'm going to get to experience this, you know, whether it's a good year or bad year. Like I'm here to experience rough grouse hunting and go see the woods. Like, 'cause I'd heard so much about it. I've seen so much, you know, and, I was like, okay. And so I go out, grouse, you know, guys are like, hey, you know, this forest or this, that, and the other thing. And I'm like, I don't have a dog with me. I got my shotgun, I got my license, and one guy who had a dog, he was going to be able to, we were going to link up, but it was going to be later. So I had some time on my own. So I get out kind of in my first area. I actually got my first grouse completely on my own, just no dog, none of that other stuff. And really cool. I was running after this stupid grouse. I saw him cross the logging trail in front of me, and then I like was trying to run and cut him off.
Randy Newberg it?
No, no, I didn't skeleton shot. I got him to flush to shoot him, and it was pretty cool. And so, but then I just started, you know, going, and I'm walking logging roads, and I'm literally flushing 4 grouse per hour.
That's great.
Okay.
That's really
No. In Minnesota, this is bad. This is bad in Minnesota. This is a bad year. It's off year. No dog. No. I'm flushing 4 grouse an hour off logging roads.
Right.
Right. And so I got a chance to later on, like we, you know, it was a dinner one of the nights and all that stuff. And I said, well, what, you know, if this is a bad year, what does a good year look like? You know, and they were like, oh, you know, I said, 'cause I was, you know, I'll do four grouse an hour any day of the week. I think that's awesome. And they said, oh yeah, it probably would have been like 12 to 15. I was like, dear God, like that's just unfathomable to me. And right. I think it's the same here with Mearns quail. I mean, you know, average years for Mearns quail, average here is a covey an hour.
Right.
For most quail species, that's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know,
you don't get that on bobwhites in Kansas. I'll tell you that right now.
On an average year to see one covey an hour,
right,
walking around out there. That's pretty awesome, you know.
Right.
You can put it in an 8-hour day, have 8 possible chances, you know.
Right.
I mean, that's fairly decent.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, when you hear, oh, you know, it's a below average year, darn, you know.
Yeah.
It might be an hour and 15 or an hour and a half for every cup.
Well, you know. Yeah, but this year was another good example in North Dakota. Everybody's like, oh man, drought must have really affected the birds. I was like, it's North Dakota, guys. It's always going to be better than most of the other alternatives for pheasants and sharptails and huns. Just like go or don't go. I don't care. But I'm telling you that there are birds and you will find them if you get out and walk. I mean, you're not going to trip over them in a Walmart parking lot, but you will find birds.
People need them jumping into their game bag really or do, something. Yeah. So.
You know, and you were talking about how, like with bird hunting, everything's really relative. Bird hunters and fishermen, to a certain extent, the farther you get into it, the more that you really just want to try to handicap yourself.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, fishermen... when you can go to a trout stream and you can catch them with not bobbers, but floats.
Right.
And egg sacks or something like that. Well, that's cheating. So we got to try to come up with some fly pattern and we got to do this. And like, I get it because I'm hunting with pointing dogs on birds that typically don't want to hold. And instead of doing it with a semi-automatic 12 gauge, I'm doing it with a side-by-side 410. Yeah. It's not hard enough to try to hit something the size of a tennis ball with something the size of a beach ball in the air when it's flying 40 miles an hour. I just got to make it that much harder for myself because it's not about killing the birds at all to me. It's about me getting out in the field and experiencing it with friends in a place that wherever it's at, that I can see the beauty in. Yeah. I don't like hunting in ugly places, which is why I come down here. I mean, like I told you guys earlier, if you guys could get two sunsets a day, this place would be pretty out of control. And I like being in the field with my dogs and watching my dogs run. If my dogs point birds, you know, you watch a covey rise like we've seen today down there when we were chasing gambles.
Right.
I'll remember that forever. I mean, we had 40 bird covey fly back over our head. Or this evening, me and Wade and you and Wolf and Josh, we kind of went out on a walk this evening after everybody else took off from the hunt to eat camp. And I had Rusty, my oldest dog, out, and I took Wade one way, and you three went the other way and did better. quite frankly, you guys shot more birds than we did. But I got to watch Rusty track down a covey of scale quail, and they flushed right in front of Wade.
Right.
And Wade loves scale quail, and he has a little bit of a curse going on with him. So, but like, it's about those experiences. We right. only killed, me and Wade killed one bird between the two of us.
Yeah.
And it's a hunt that I'll always remember. Like, it doesn't, the number of birds you kill doesn't matter.
Sure.
Like, it's consequential. So,
yeah. Well, we talked about that actually with some of the participants here, you know, like you know, which, talked about your first hunt and, mm-hmm. and those kind of things, but you know, I mean, when you talk about memorable hunts and all that other stuff, I think there's just too many to list, you know, and all for very different reasons.
Right.
Like you could say, what was, you know, your favorite hunt for this species or that species, or you know, what's your most memorable because of, you know, something sentimental or, you know,
right.
There's so many of those, you know, as you kind of go along that it's hard to even just pin down.
Well, you know. I mean, you asked me what's my favorite state to hunt. I couldn't even do that.
Sure.
I can't give you one,
you know, well, and we were talking about, obviously, you know, it was the first year I met you,
mm-hmm.
Actually down here in the Avenue.
Yep.
And got introduced to Craig Jones. I mean,
yep.
that guy, my such limited interaction
yep.
with a hunter you just drug down here with you,
yeah.
Had such a profound impact
yeah.
on me, you know, very long lasting. Like it was crazy to me. We went up into the poker room
mm-hmm.
and there's a bottle sitting there and it just like, that was, I got yeah. taken right back to that moment yep. and thinking about Craig and just kind of, you know,
yeah. You get a little misty still.
Yeah. And I mean, if for those of you who don't know, Craig Jones was a guy that, Tyler had met through
social media.
Through social media.
Like it's a crazy story. I mean, you know, the whole reason that we're all that you and I are sitting here doing podcasts, at this place and know each other is because Ron Baim started the Hunting Dog Podcast.
Yeah.
And I listened to it because I was a rural mail carrier and I was tired of listening to the friggin' radio. And so on the third episode, he has this crazy dude on there named Craig Jones. Yeah. And I could instantly tell that I liked him. Yeah. Like, he's mischievous and he's very much full of it. And he's just got all these wild stories. And so I sent him a message on Facebook. And this is 2014, yeah. 7 years ago. And he on the podcast, he's talking about coming to North Dakota every year to hunt pheasants. So I sent him a message. I was like, man, if you really want to do some bird hunting, not just pheasants, but bird hunting in North Dakota, get a hold of me. I said, I'll take you out. And so we kind of, this is like May or June. And so we start sending messages back and forth over Facebook. And then pretty quick, it turns into a meme war. And then it turns into us, you know, trying to do stupid things with our dogs to make each other laugh. And then phone calls and everything else. And then pretty quick, he calls me. He's like, dude, we're going to be up there the last week of October. Do you have a day that we could meet up and just hunt someplace in between? And I said, yeah, man. I said, but come all the way up to Minot. It's where I was living. And he came up and he brought five friends with. And they're like, well, we're just going to hunt for the day. And I was like, okay. And we had so much fun. They're like, man, would you mind if we just stayed and hunt one more? Well, hunt in the morning and then take off. Ended up staying for 4 days. Like, we just instantly hit it off. It was like we were long lost friends that we'd never met before, just right. met in person for the first time. And so it all kind of led to that next year. He was going to come down here with us the first year that I came down here in 15. Mm-hmm. And when 15 or 16, I can't remember. 16, maybe.
16, yeah, I think.
16. And when we were supposed to be leaving, him and another friend of ours, Bruce, they were driving. They were going to be driving down to someplace in Tennessee and flying out because it was too cold in Michigan for them to fly their dogs down here.
Right.
And so they're in a van and Craig has a seizure. And thankfully Bruce was driving, but he had a seizure, 45 years old, zero history of epilepsy or anything else. Instantly, when I got the phone call from Bruce, I was like, that's bad. And it turns out it was stage 4 brain cancer. He had a tumor a little bit bigger than a golf ball on the side of his head, on the side of his brain. And so from the hospital bed, I was down here when we get the news. He calls me and he says, hey, I sent that 28 gauge down there with you. That I bought that gun to shoot quail in Arizona. He said, you have to shoot it. And I was like, okay. Sounds good to me, you know, whatever. And he says, I'll be up and at him, and I'll be ready to go, and I'll be down there next year. Well, stage 4 glioblastoma, he was diagnosed. He was given 6 months to a year to live. And he was down here that next year, and we hunted hard, like really hard.
Yeah.
But it was a year after his diagnosis. He wasn't even supposed to be here. So he had this clock that he carried around in his truck. And it said, he set the clock as a countdown from 365 days. And after that, every day after that, you know, you'd call him and talk to him and be like, how's it going? He's like, well, not supposed to be here, still here, you know? Huh. And he really had that kind of mentality. And he came down here and we lit it up, man. It was fun. Oh. And he brought a bunch of Pappy Van Winkle bourbon and cigars, and we drank way too expensive bourbon and hunted a lot, and we shared a million laughs.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, and it was amazing. I mean, it was like first of all, like, for any of you who know Pappy Van Winkle's like bourbon, right. it's you know how hard it is to come by. Yeah. First and foremost. There are lines outside liquor stores most states on release day every year.
Right.
And only so many get sold, and it's hard. For those who don't know, this is a really highly sought after bourbon.
Yeah, top of the pyramid.
Yeah, it has a long history, a big name, and does not go for cheap.
No.
At all.
And brought a freaking case.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so when I walked into the Avenue and meet Tyler and these guys and Craig's there and stuff, and I like see all this bourbon, I mean, I was like, I am immediately outclassed, outshined, walking in here going, okay, this is a whole new world for me, because like there was he had the box of cigars that's dipped in Pappy's, and I'm like, what is going on? And so I had mentioned earlier, you know, we walked up into the poker room, and there sits on the table an empty bottle of the 10-year Pappy Van Winkle and stuff. And so I just had to grab it, and, you know, made me really kind of think back to Craig you know, that dude was just, you know,
it really does tie back into the conversation that we've been having, though. I mean, I would have never met him without social media.
Yeah.
He was an influential cog in my life. I mean, from only knowing him for, like, we were only friends for 5 years, 4 years before he passed away. Yeah. But he'll go down in history as one of my greatest friends ever. Yeah. And he taught me so much about how to live in the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, when a person of that age is literally given a death sentence, and you have now your life has an end date. It has an expiration date. And to just kind of look at things in just change his perspective like that.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right.
Well, there were so many things that he said that did have a profound, you know, they were very profound in and of themselves, but also to look the man in the face, you know, that, you know, one of his biggest regrets that he was not going to outlive his bird dog. You know, that his goal was to, you know, just hunt every borrowed day.
Yep.
Hunt every place and every bird he could along the way.
Yep.
You know, that after that trip, you know, him saying, you know, John, I'll be back here next year to hunt Merns Quail. You know, and it was just like, I hope you do.
Yeah.
You know, because he was just every day, like, it just,
his enthusiasm for life was just unbelievable.
Like he, you know, he convinced me that he could, I'm going to be here next year.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He told me the same thing. And he said, you know, from the day that he left here, he said, countdown starts to September 1st. And I was like, yeah, it does. Oh. And then in April, he had to have another brain surgery where he lost sight in an eye, in his left eye. And he called me and he's like, well, at least it's not the right eye. I'm right eye dominant. I can still shoot. He's like, good for you, man. And then he was walking. And then that spring, he went up and he did a bear hunt in Canada in May. And like, he's up there with one eye, walking around with a cane because his one leg doesn't work anymore. And then he was at my place September 1st. And he couldn't really walk much. And he was in a lot of pain. And couldn't see out of his left eye, but we put him out on a bucket to shoot doves, and shit, he still shot better than most people I know. Like, I think he was going, he was running like 1 for 4 or something like that with one eye and not being able to walk and everything else. And he was just having a blast. You know, he's sitting there with his dog, sending his dog for retrieves and just laughing and enjoying it for what it was. You know, he really did think that, you know, he wasn't supposed to be there then. Yeah. So that was just an extra, that was bonus time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really, I think that's kind of what really started shaping my view of changing my view on what hunting is.
Yeah.
It's about those stories and those relationships that you make. And, you know, I don't care that the last time that we were out hunting together, we were sitting on bucket shooting doves, and I think we've shot like 8 or something like that. It doesn't matter. Like,
it's more the fact you were together.
We were there. He was there. You know, he wasn't supposed to be there, but he was. He said he was going to be there, and he was. And, you know, it's, you kind of just can't take that for granted. You know, he died when he was 47 years old.
Oh.
You know, it's one of those things that it really does. It gives a person a lot of pause. You know, makes you think about things just a little bit differently.
Yeah, it does. It's it was rough when I got the news from you. Mm-hmm. You know, that he had passed, and it was just like the air just. I remember you and I at your place when we got a setback announcement.
Yep.
You know, and it just took the air out of the room and just like, you know.
Yeah, the tumor was back. I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was hard. But yeah. But yeah, he did. I certainly the one thing, I mean, it's such an impactful story that, you know, I think he had, even on both of us, but yeah, to teach us more, like, you know,
there's a lot more to this game.
There's a little, yeah, you know, do your living while you can.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Some things are going to matter. Some things don't matter
at all.
Most
things are not going to matter at all.
Yeah. Buy Pappy Van Winkle bourbon. drink it every chance you get.
I think that's what kept him alive as long as it did.
that might be a new medical treatment.
He literally called it the lifeblood for a while, and I think he may have been onto something. If Pappy Van Winkle wants to send me some, I'm willing to test it.
Test the theory. Well, you know, I mean, after the namesake of Rip Van Winkle, right, I mean,
right, exactly. In fact, that bottle upstairs is Rip Van Winkle, I believe.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's you know, it's all about perspective. I mean, if you go out in the field and you want to be upset if you see somebody else, or you're not going to be happy if you don't get a limit, or you're not going to be happy if your dog doesn't do everything perfectly, you're just probably not going to be happy a lot.
Yeah.
If you go out into the field and watch a beautiful sunrise and enjoy the place that you're in, laugh with your friends and enjoy the experience for what it is and not be so goal-oriented, mm-hmm. you're just going to be a lot happier person in general.
Sure.
And, I mean, you're going to get a lot more out of it.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's either that or you kind of live with the notion, you know, that, you know, maybe hunting dies with you.
Sure.
Because you don't spread it on anyone and you don't want anyone else there and not bringing anyone else in.
Yeah.
You're the last one.
Yep.
Go ahead and enjoy that place all to yourself exactly. Because you'll be the last one who does.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we'll put in a 7-Eleven tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, Dollar Generals are popping up all over.
Family Dollars, yeah. Whatever else it is. It's kind of, I don't know. It's not... not a pleasant thought, at least I think for me.
It's not for me either.
You know, I'd much rather share some of those, because having an experience, I mean, there are some experiences that it is nice, you know, to just hold and know that that's yours.
Right.
You know, but at the same time, there are other ones where they're shared experiences, you know, much like Craig Jones, mm-hmm. you know. You didn't own him to yourself. I didn't own him to myself.
No, nope.
You know, but he's a memory that we share.
That we share. Made us closer.
In a lot of different ways. And so, and hunting, I mean, you know, for us to get out and kick around you know, some of the stupid things.
Oh my gosh.
You know, making fun of how Wade shoots. That's a perfect pastime for us.
Even though he doesn't shoot that bad, hopefully he doesn't listen to this, but he shoots pretty damn good.
Speaking of the devil, he just walked in behind us to hear us. Had to poke the bear just a little bit.
Well, but, he said that we were going to end up talking until daybreak, and until it's getting midnight. Close.
Yeah. So just for folks who are looking for Tyler and want to tune in on some of his adventures and a lot of the upland stuff that he puts out, some really great content. You've got the Instagram account.
It's Birds, Booze, and Buds on Instagram. And I think that you can pretty much search that almost anywhere. It's that on YouTube as well. Just crossed 1,000 subscribers. Woohoo. I'm going to be putting out a ton of stuff. Like I said, I'm getting an actual camera person to follow me around next year, and that's all going to live on YouTube.
What I find impressive as well, and so this is just like another feather in your cap, Tyler, is that if all you search for is birds, booze, you don't need anything more, because no one in the history of the world has put those two words together in any form or fashion other than you. So you don't have to remember just birds and booze.
Yeah.
It's all good. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it comes up right away.
What else really is there?
Very, very appropriate. But I'm looking forward to seeing your adventure next year.
It's going to be just like everything else that I do in the outdoors. It's all going to be shared. So whoever's in my camp, whenever we're filming, they're going to be on YouTube.
On an NFL.
Because I'm not a, I'm like, it's all about the people that I hunt with, and there's a lot of them, and there's a lot of crazy ones that come in and out of my place, or the people that are going to be on that trip to Alaska, them are going to be some of the craziest ones. And then all the people down here. So, it's going to be a shared adventure for everybody.
For sure. No, it sounds like a great time. I can't wait.
I'm still waiting. Wade's got to retire soon because I need a running partner.
There you go.
Yeah, and his wife doesn't really like him that much.
Yeah, yeah. So I know she wants us to keep him as long as we can, like, down here. So
I'm just going to kidnap him for about 6 or 7 weeks a year, and we're going to go and do some stuff, and then, you know, I'll give him back when I'm done.
He can find his way home. He probably knows the way. Well, thanks, Tyler. Appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Buddy. Absolutely. I'm glad you came down this weekend.
Check him out. Hope you enjoy the podcast, folks. We'll have another episode coming up here again soon.